Moving Iron Podcast is proud to be part of the Global Ag Network. The network is live, so check out globalagnetwork.com for more details and updates. Now on to the show.
Moving Iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Moving Iron time and time again.
Hello and welcome to Moving Iron Podcast number 150. Today my guest will be Aaron Fintel, as usual, as running shotgun here on the old Moving Iron Podcast. And then I got Jordan Kite from AgriService will be on up after Aaron. So Aaron, how you doing, buddy?
Good, man, good. Just another beautiful, feels like early fall, even though it's late summer day, which isn't good for late crops.
No, it's not.
Just another beautiful day from the worldwide headquarters of Open Stone Farms.
Right on. So today, you know, we kind of hit something about every week we go on here. We talk about stuff that's going on. Last week we talked about what we saw happen in the auction market. And this week, I think, is an underserved market. I think that a lot of guys, unless you're like knee-deep into that area, it's hay. And we haven't talked about that much here on the show, so I want to spend a little time talking about hay and what we see happen in the hay market and what we see going on around there. So, Aaron, why don't you talk a little bit about what you see happening in the hay market right now and as far as equipment goes and how things are moving out there as far as windrowers and some balers go.
In general, hay equipment for us specifically is super hot.
Right.
I feel like new baler sales took a while to get going, but I think we've sold more balers in August than I can ever remember.
Yeah.
There was a lot of days where it was five a day, and that's very odd. Typically they're June and early July. The bulk of our round baler sales, the bulk, not all, and this, you know, within our entire AOR is pretty much ranchers and grass hay. You know, most of the commercial alfalfa guys are all square bales here, just like everywhere else. But the bulk of our round baler sales is the grass hay market, rancher market. And I know those guys had a heck of a time. You know, southern South Dakota, western Nebraska, eastern Wyoming, northern Colorado, just wet.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, I know everything was kind of delayed and this and that, but it still feels like pretty late for balers, even though realizing they are late and behind, it still feels late. But selling balers like hotcakes. I have spent all summer trying to get any kind of windrower that makes sense and that isn't a piece of junk bought.
Right. Yeah.
For our customer base. Just cannot get enough late model used windrowers to satisfy the buyer market locally for us. Just been really, really hot. I know there was pretty much third cutting, you know, for our Bridgeport, Scotts Bluff, Alliance stores in Nebraska is non-existent. There was a lot of beautiful third cutting alfalfa ready to roll and just pounded with hail.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine has a circle across the road and it was gorgeous. And got hailed out Friday morning, and Monday they were going to cut it.
Right, yeah.
So that's kind of a tough pill to swallow. I know nationwide, I know eastern Nebraska, Iowa, guys have had a heck of a lot of trouble getting hay put up in general. And nationally, It's not new to the industry. I think it's a little new to the North American round baler market for deer, but the pre-cutter is gaining a lot of popularity. Here with it being wet, I know a few dealers have sold some kind of last-minute deal, like, well, let's pre-cut it and let's, you know, marshmallow wrap it and go that route, because there is no other way you're going to get it up, you know. If, and it's and I know I've talked to a couple guys in eastern Iowa that were dealing with that scenario, and, you know, they were to the point where, I'm going to roll the stuff up wet, throw it in a ditch somewhere just to get it off so maybe we can get the next cutting.
Right.
You know, it was that drastic. So there's been a little bit of, you know, with the fighting wetness and everywhere, that's definitely affected the hay market. The, you know, lack of temperatures in some areas has been a negative to the hay market, a plus to other hay market areas. You know, it's just kind of a crapshoot out there. But I would say that nationally, as far as I'm aware, the hay market, you know, used hay equipment is pretty good.
Yeah,
it's a pretty good market by and large. So,
yeah, that's for sure. I mean, you take a look at anything that's going on out there right now when it comes to hay, it's on both ends of the extreme. There's not a lot of places right now that have that, oh, we have perfect growing conditions. You know, it's either too wet, not enough heat units, or it's too dry. And
right,
there's no perfect thing going right now. And the hay equipment, I will say, during this downturn has been the one thing, and you can argue this from a bunch of different points, but used hay equipment through the downturn has been the one thing that has stayed pretty consistent and pretty hot and heavy, because it's always that thing that guys have $25,000, you know, laying around that they can go get that new baler, right? Or they've got $50,000 to go get the new swather, or, you know, $70,000 or whatever the number is. You know, when it comes to hay and forage, I'm surprised that there's as much, it has been as consistent as it's been. There's never been a time when it's been super, super duper hot and we can't get enough of anything, but it's never been super duper low, but it's just been consistently the same value. You know, you can argue that maybe the last 6 months, 18 months, something like that, you start to see a little bit of a trickle up in value, but I think for the most part, it stayed pretty consistent across the board. What do you think? Think it's a pretty fair statement?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The one thing that I would point out is I can remember maybe 4 years ago where, and in our area, we've never, ever, in the 12 years I've been here, 13 years I've been here, had round baler issues.
Right.
We just don't.
Right. Right.
and there are certain times where windrowers kind of pile up a little bit, but for the last 2 years, for sure, it doesn't matter if it's a 4890 with 5,000 hours, or hell, even an old 3830, all the way up to used W260s, they just fly out of here.
Right.
So it has been a bright spot, especially when you compare it to the combine market.
Yep.
just thought I'd sprinkle that in there.
Yeah.
So it has been a bright spot, and I would honestly say the biggest comment for it being a bright, or the biggest factor in it being a bright spot, is just what you said: consistency.
Right. It's been pretty consistent.
It's about that and planters for probably the last 2 years are the only things that have a clue about consistency.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Even tractors aren't there right now.
Yeah. So since we're on this hay and forage topic today, there's one actually of all the things out there right now that have just taken the beating. I mean, when it comes to used, just gets just kicked around, and that's choppers, right? And
right.
But I will say this. I've noticed over the last 4 months, maybe even go back 6 months, that there has been a steady incline in demand when you come start looking at forage harvesters. And not now, I will say this: it is not the 1 year old, 2 year old chopper. It's that, you know, that 50 series, that 10 series, series,
80s.
You know, yeah, the 80s. You know, those series of choppers, guys are actually kind of starting to look at. And I think the reason for that is, they're the custom guys, and this is my pure speculation. So if you're a custom guy out there and I'm wrong, please hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram here at Moving On LLC. But when I look at this, I think it's because there's the forge guys have gotten to be so busy and they're doing so many jobs that some of the smaller jobs they're passing on those, and these guys are buying that $150,000, $100,000, $200,000 chopper to go out and do 300 to 500 acres with. And I think that's where I've seen that demand come from. I guess when you talk to folks about, are you hearing something like that too when you're talking to folks out there on the phone?
Well, I try real hard not to bring up choppers, Casey, ever.
Because you get beat up.
Just,
right?
on the off chance they want to trade one on something that is not a chopper on my end.
Yeah, I totally get that, yeah.
But, you know, one thing, as you were saying that, I think you're partly right. I think another reason of it is just like everything in the ag sector, and even in the non-ag sector, but especially in ag, labor.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you can actually, and I know this from a couple guys that have jumped from a pull type into a smaller 7000-aught, 7050 series.
Right.
You know, they've gotten rid of the, you know, pull type and the dump wagon and the trucks. They already got the truck, so they get rid of the pull type and the dump wagon, or they go to, you know, say they were using the old forage wagons, you know, the four-chain job.
Yep.
And there's been a few of those guys that even, you know, yeah, it still takes labor because you got a guy driving the chopper and a guy driving the truck and somebody piling. But they have gone that route because it's less labor.
Mm-hmm.
You need, instead of, you know, say you're out there with a 3975 pull type and a 3-row head, well, just sheer time, you're going to need whatever said labor is longer versus let's hop in this thing and chew this off and pile it up and the labor can go.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
so,
that's a good point, too. I never really thought about
instead
that.
Instead of finding somebody so-so that might know what they're doing for 2 weeks, they find a guy that doesn't know what he's doing for 2 days, and there you go.
Yep. And that's the other thing,
and
too.
You know, they're kind of a necessary evil for beef industry, dairy industry, whatever, you know.
Got to have knowledge.
Yeah, you got to have them, and a lot of those guys are, I mean, that's kind of where they sit. You know, hell, they don't want to have their chopper either, but when it's go time, and everybody's here, so let's knock it out, and here we go.
Yeah. Okay. So the other side of that, too, is like everything else, these choppers are getting bigger and bigger, right? So
right.
Kloss has got, 980, and the equivalent is John Deere 9900, which is the new one that came out. We got 12-row heads, and these things are massive, 1,000-horsepower rigs. You know, they've just got just tons of juice, which always comes back to the fun story of what do you do with the that used when it comes back in. It's a $450,000 or $500,000 get-up with the pickup head and the row crop head, so the rotary head. So it's a, again, that kind of goes back to that, what do you do with that first-generation trade-in, and I'm less scratching my head on some of those.
I think all I can really tell you to do, and I've been in the used equipment business for a decade here, but I think really when you get to that point, you just punt. You just walk away and let somebody else figure it out.
So a whole bunch of new ones and drop your forge contract.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, I'm not doing it anymore. Sorry
about that. That would be an awful thing to do, folks. We're just joking. But that is I see that happen a lot. Now, I will say this. The dealers that are tuned into that, and they're the ones that do that in and out year after year thing, they seem to figure it out. They seem to get through them. It might take some, you know, it all depends on dairy price, right? Dairy prices are up. Beef prices are up. Choppers fly out here, especially if there's a drought. You know, there's a drought someplace, and they got to go chop a bunch of stuff. You see an impact chopper. We're seeing some demand on our used choppers within our yard right now because of all the hell we've got right now, right? So we're starting to see some things happening there. So, I mean, you talked about a machine that is niched. There's, I don't know, other than my adage has always been, outside of sugarcane harvesters, I think the next most niched machine that is not a, you know, picking blueberries or something like that, it's a forage harvester, you know, because, I mean, you're not really doing much. Unless there's a zombie apocalypse, I guess you could turn the rotary head on and mow a path, but you'd be all right. But I don't, it is such a niche thing, and trying to figure out how to make those moving parts all fit on the use side is always a struggle.
Yeah, and I know, you know, besides the buzzword of agriculture for the entire year, the hemp business is actually firing up a little bit of chopper sales too, because it seems like no matter, at least from what I can tell across the country, you have five guys that are growing hemp, and they're doing five completely different ways of harvest.
Yeah.
You know, I know guys that are putting shellborn headers on choppers and going that route.
Yeah.
I know guys that are, you know, got drapers on choppers, guys that are combining it, you know, then sloughing and chopping. It's just seems like five guys are going to do five different ways, and I have obviously have no clue what's the right way to do it and what's not, but there is, you know, that's plays into all kinds of equipment mixes, you know, as far as that goes, so. Well, and choppers are a big part of that from what I have seen.
Yep. Well, I can tell you this much. To me, right now, the hemp industry in the United States is very much like a gold rush. A lot of people are jumping in thinking it's going, oh, I just got to show up and we get all this money, and it's not that way, you know.
Right.
I will say next year, I mean, under the 2020, I think it's 2020, the 2020 Farm Bill, you can insure hemp. So that'll open some doors up to maybe some, you know, some farmers, actually some real hardcore, like that's my job for the last 30 years farming, you know, farmers will step into that ring and start taking a look at it and see what they can make happen. But man, it's a lot of folks are going to may either make a bunch of money or lose everything they've got. And it's probably going to be more towards the latter, when you start looking at things like this. So very cautious about that business right now. And, not saying I'm not interested in it. Not saying that I'm not, you know, see, there's some bullish trends there in the hemp market. It's just there's a lot of people that don't know what they're doing, and it's a very expensive learning curve that they have to figure out when it comes to farming and the areas that people are growing the stuff and the weather that comes with that and all the different things. It's a big deal, and I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what happens over the next 3 to 5 years in that industry.
Yep, that's exactly right. Interesting is exactly right.
So, all right. Well, I think we got her pretty well whipped here in our little hay and forage talk for this week on the Moving Iron Podcast. So, Aaron, if folks want to reach out to you and pick your brain about what's going on or just see what kind of hot deals you got cooking, how would you do that?
Well, you can catch me on the Twitterverse at Aaron Fintel, or call me, text me, what have you, 308-760-1193.
All right, buddy. Well, Aaron, take care of yourself. We'll catch you down the road, man.
Right on, man.
Moving Iron.
All right, we're back, and I am joined with Jordan Kite, and he's with AgriService, and he is the new and used equipment asset manager for AgriService in Kimberly, Idaho. So, Jordan, man, thanks for being on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, man. Why don't you give me a little background on yourself, talk about, you know, kind of what you do for the company, and then talk about AgriService, what they are, and kind of the area they cover, and some of the crops you got in your area.
Okay. So my background, I've been in the asset management position, I guess, for about just over 6 years. I was a store manager before that for one of our locations. AgriService is an AGCO dealer, so we have Challenger, Massey Ferguson. We also have the Fendt line now. So we have basically their whole portfolio of products that they cover. We cover Idaho. We're into We have a location right on the border of Oregon and Idaho, and so we cover into Oregon, and then we have locations up in Washington as well. So okay. I cover that area. Okay. Our main crops, we've got potatoes, obviously, in Idaho is our number one. We also do a lot of hay. We do wheat, barley, and sugar beets is our main crops okay. we have out here.
Right on. Do a little sugar beets down here myself, so that's an interesting crop.
Yeah, it is.
It's very interesting. All right, man. So let's jump into this a little bit. So we, here just a little bit ago, Aaron Fennell and I were talking back and forth about some hay stuff. And, you know, that seems to be one of the, since this downturn started in 2013 to where we're at today, the hay market's been one of those consistent markets out there. You know, when you start, at least it has been in my neck of the woods. It's been a fairly consistent market. I mean, there's either been a drought someplace or not enough. Or too much rain or not enough heat units or early springs that zapped alfalfa or what have you, and dairy quality hay is getting to be a bigger and bigger commodity as you start looking at how they're feeding cows nowadays. So I guess talk about your hay market right now and what you see happening there, and then transition that into what you see happening in the overall hay equipment marketplace.
So here in Idaho right now, Idaho, I guess I should pull Washington into that because we do a lot up there also. Right now the hay market is good. Last hay report that came out, we're right, you know, $200 a ton for good hay. Your fair hay is between $150, $165 a ton. So decent numbers on the hay. I mean, a couple of years ago we got up into that, you know, $280. It was too high, I guess. So it's kind of leveled off. It's been below that. But right now we're feeling pretty good about where the hay prices are. Farmers are doing well with it. We also do the export market. The export market is an interesting beast in of itself. You know, right now you've got Japan that wants more. India wants more. China's down. I think a lot of that. China's kind of an interesting, I don't know how to describe it. I don't even fully understand China and some of the stuff that goes on. But right now that's low. That's probably affecting us, our export guys here, more than anything right now. I mean, China's usually doing about 4.5 million tons of hay. And so for them right now to be down can affect us for sure. But the dairies here, the feedlots, they're buying hay, which is good. That keeps kind of the local business here. The guys that aren't exporting are feeling pretty good.
So the overall, you say the overall health of the alfalfa market is fairly strong in your area. Do you talk to some other folks around the country that are kind of echoing what you're saying?
You know, I don't talk to a lot of other guys around the country. I mean, we usually deal with guys, you know, Colorado West, I would say, you know, Wyoming guys, Idaho guys. Everybody's kind of the same. Just, I mean, there's pockets where it's doing better, pockets where it's doing worse.
Right.
You know, and a lot of that depends on where cattle are at. You know, cattle are kind of level, trending down a little bit, and so that could affect the hay market also in some of those pockets. But, yeah, overall I would say hay is good right now.
Yeah. Alfalfa hay is another one of those things, too, that really trends with the what you see happen with the dairy market as well. So when that starts to kind of go down a little bit, you start seeing it there. But it's one of those things, too, that they have to buy it. They have to feed the cows, right? So it's one of those things that it's you know, there's ebbs and flows like you talked about earlier, but it seems like it's the dairy market does have a big effect on the overall price of hay.
Yep. Yeah.
All right, man. So let's jump into some equipment talk right now. So I imagine where you guys are out, you're out there doing big 4x4, 3x4 type bales, those kind of stuff. So talk about that baler market a little bit and what you see happening there.
Yeah, we have a lot of 4x4 guys. We're starting to see a shift of more of the 3x4s. We have hay presses out here. A lot of the hay presses want 3x4 bales more than they want 4x4 bales. The export guys want 3x4 bales. But a lot of the dairies is where they really want the 4x4 bales. So we still have a pretty strong 4x4 market, but we're seeing it switch and go to the 3x4 market a little bit more. So I see that transition continuing as more guys start, you know, shipping their hay further and getting it out of their area. I think we'll probably start seeing more and more 3x4 balers being sold here and less 4x4s.
Yep. So what are you doing to combat that right now? I mean, that is the crux, I guess, of this business. If you look at it, you know, when you start seeing that trend line happen, you just got to start making some decisions on how you're going to start either, especially in your position, how you're going to position yourself with new product, and then how you're going to position yourself with maybe a product that has lost its luster that used to be a big seller for you.
Yeah. You know, we're starting, I mean, we started the last year or so. We're just ordering less 4x4 balers, more 3x4 balers as we see that happening. I mean, there will always be a 4x4 market. I think there's just guys that's what they prefer. The big farms that are feeding their own hay, they're set up for 4x4, so they don't have a reason to change. And so I think we'll still, you know, always see those 4x4s, but we've just tried to follow that trend a little bit every year, depending on where we're selling them and are ordering less 4x4s, more 3x4s in, and then just kind of watching it. You know, with the balers, we also have the tandem axles and the single axles.
Right.
And that's two that we have to watch, because there's guys out there that absolutely will not run one or the other. You know, if they're a tandem guy, they're a tandem guy, and you can't pay me enough to sit there and pull a single, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And so that's another challenge that we face is, you know, when you're trying to, I mean, the new side is fairly easy. We know the guys that want tens, we know the guys that want singles. We can track that demand year to year. But on the used side, it poses a little bit of a problem, because if you've got all the single guys trading one year, and so you've got a lot of single balers, but you got tandem used buyers, then, you know, we have to play that game too and try to make sure we're bringing in both in at the same time and keep it flowing.
Yep. Okay, so do you feel like that 3x4 market is kind of trending more towards the niche market for the export side, or do you feel like there's going to be some local guy feeding their own stuff kind of transition more into that? Do you feel, I guess, just kind of listen to what you say there?
Yeah, I mean, the local guys are also transitioning mm-hmm. a little bit more to the 3x4, and a lot of it is on shipping. The reason that they are transitioning, the guys that the hay is staying local, where I'm located at in Kimberly, Idaho, we're sitting here and we've got dairies. I mean, I can see dairies from our office windows. I mean, there are just a lot of dairies around. And so the guys that are producing hay for dairies and the dairies want 4x4s, you know, those guys will keep doing 4x4 bales because they ship it right down the street, or the dairies loaded up from the fields themselves. But the guys that are not, I guess, contracted with dairies or don't have their hay sold before they put it up and are shipping it, those are the guys that seem to be looking more 3x4 right now.
Yeah. So in your area, do you have a round bale presence, or is it more commercial stuff that the guys are doing?
We're mostly commercial. We do have some, I mean, we cover down into Nevada a little bit, and then Wyoming. You know, we've got stores on the border there, and so Wyoming's a round baler market, so we definitely have round balers going into those areas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where I'm at, we really don't have a lot of round balers at all.
Yeah, just the bulk of it's just going to be the commercial side, the large square bale stuff.
Yep.
Yep. All right, so let's talk about what you see happening in the swather market. So you can't have one without the other. So as you take a look at some of these swathers, it feels like to me the swather market, especially on the youth side of the business right now, is very hot. There's not high, I don't know, hot's probably not the right word, but very consistent and very steady. We have plenty of demand for used windrowers. So talk about that market right now, what you see happen in your area.
Yeah, it's definitely the same. I mean, yeah, I don't know if hot's the right word, but it's definitely right now we are moving windrowers. We, you know, starting the season this last spring, I was a little bit concerned about where we were at on the used side, but right now we've burned through, you know, a lot of those machines, where right now the sales guys are looking and saying, hey, we need some more used swathers because we got guys that want to buy them. And so that's been good. Our new market has also picked up a lot. We're selling a lot of new units also. So I would say the swather market right now is hotter than the baler market, which usually they kind of run together, but right now the Baylors seem to be shifting up and the Windrowers are kind of slowing down just a little bit, and so maybe it's just tracking behind them this year. But yeah, the Haymarket or the our hay machines are definitely moving right now pretty good.
Yeah. So when you look at the overall on the new side of the business, when you're taking a look at that, is there a shift in the market where you're seeing one conditioner in your area that's maybe kind of starting to become a prevalent one, or has it always been the same thing?
We sell more double conditioners than we do single conditioners.
Yeah.
I would say the majority of the big producers are running double conditioners. They are definitely doubles. We do have some, we have a couple big guys running singles, and a lot of it is just, you know, conditions where they're at. You know, if they're heavy dew, if they get rainfall, you know, every evening, those guys sometimes don't want the doubles, but overall, if they're a decent sized producer or exporter, they want the double conditioner. So we do sell a lot of those.
Do you have much triple mount business out there with the front PTOs and tractors and stuff? Do you have anything like that going on out there?
We've got a couple of them, some dairies that are running them that are just chopping right behind them. And so they do those, but there's only a couple of them that I can think of that are running those.
Not very many people using them to actually bell with, or just run it to do the forage aspect, but kind of speed that process up.
Yeah. Yep. Just forage.
I gotcha. Okay, that makes sense, I guess. I mean, you're laying down three rows at a time, so you can definitely get across that field 30 feet wide usually. You can knock down quite a bit pretty quick. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. All right, so when you look at what's going on with those balers that you see out there, that 150 to 200 horsepower tractor has got to be a pretty big seller for you. So what do you see happening in that marketplace?
Yeah. You know, our tractor market is, I mean, we have a pretty good sized tractor market out here, obviously with all the row crops we do. And then with the hay, I would say the 150 to 200 horse tractors are moving pretty good. It seems the over 200 have slugged a little bit, slowed down.
Yeah.
But that 150 to 200 seems to be a real sweet spot. So especially pulling these balers, you know, the 3x4s, you know, most guys want to have 150 horse just to make sure they can handle that weight. So that 150 to 200 is what guys want to bail with. And so, you know, for us, that's a good area or a good spot of a tractor.
Is that a pretty much a dual threat tractor with you guys out there with the baler, and then also as a chore tractor, kind of feed tractor, those kind of things sitting to feed wagons, those kind of things? Is that kind of where that tractor's falling into that niche?
Yeah. Some of the guys that run, you know, that pull feed boxes or manure spreaders go a little bit bigger. They go in that 205 to 250 range, but,
right.
You know, a lot of them will still use their smaller ones for that too.
Gotcha. Yep. Is there a lot of bell processors?
Bell processors.
Yeah, there we go. A lot of bell processors out there right now working. Is that a pretty big business for you guys?
We sell a handful. I mean, the bell processors we sell a lot of them to either feedlots or guys feeding mother cows. There's a handful of dairies that run bell processors. I mean, a lot of guys will use, and maybe this is what you're referring to, but we got the feed boxes that'll have the processor in that
right.
to chop up hay to eliminate that.
Yeah.
So, you know, every dairy's got at least one, if not two, you know, feed box / processors, and so there's a fair amount of them running around. We have a few pretty good sized feed lots that also, you know, running them around too.
Yeah. Yep. When you take a look at what's going on right now, and you got all this, you got all these different factors weighing into the market. You got trade, you've got weather, you've got low commodity prices, you got beef prices that are kind of bouncing all over the place with the Tyson fire a couple of weeks ago. It's just a lot of uncertainty out there. So when you take a look at your marketplace between now and the end of the year, what's your feel for the market? What's your kind of crystal ball say to you?
Yeah. You know, I'm optimistic. I guess I'm usually optimistic. And so I look at it and I say, you know, our hay price is good. You know, our early spuds, or not early spuds, but our fresh pack spuds right now are looking good. Most of those are contracted. So the projections are good on those. You know, I'm optimistic that we'll have a good year end, that there'll be guys that need to buy equipment, look at rolling it out. So I'm optimistic with everything that's going on. I mean, the weather's something we can't control. It's I wish we could.
Right, no kidding, right?
Yeah. That we can't control, and so I just look at it and, you know, I guess I'm optimistic. I don't think it's going to be a massive, huge. Right. You know, everybody's thrilled out of their mind running in here to buy equipment, us or any other dealership. But I feel that there'll be plenty of guys that'll need to buy equipment. So
yep, no, I'm with it. Kind of have that cautious optimism myself. That's kind of where I'm at. You know, I think there's going to be enough stuff towards the end of the year that we're going to see a bit of a spike that we haven't seen in a while. But
yep.
But I think there's also going to be some. I think the first year is going to be some more. Kind of carry over a little bit. I think I just feel like there's going to be some good things happen.
Yep.
I don't know. What? How do you feel about next year? I mean, you can take a look at 2020 as a whole. I know it's a long ways away, but it'll be here before you know it. Kind of when you look out there, do you feel kind of the same view on kind of what you're looking at, or do you have maybe some reservations about heading into an election year like we're going into?
Yeah, it always, you know, the election years always seem to. I don't know. They make me a little bit nervous just because you never know what's going to happen. It seems like right. Everything goes up and down so quickly.
Right.
But I think it'll be good. I think we'll still have a good year. You know, I hope commodities stay so the farmers can make money. It'll be interesting to see. One thing that I'm really curious to see how it plays out is the tax law change on the leases.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. We have farmers asking us, you know, what we feel about it and asking us the details, and it's like you need to talk to your accountant about that because I don't want to give you that advice.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you that.
But we've got some guys that are looking, instead of these leases that they've always had, they're looking at buying out their current leases, keeping them, you know, and so that'll be interesting to see what happens, because there are a lot of guys that want to buy equipment on a lease just because they want that payment. But if the incentive isn't there to do that, or it's, you know, messes up their balance sheet, then I guess, you know, I don't know how that'll happen. It could potentially slow down sales if guys want to purchase it and run it longer, you know, where they don't have that benefit. So that's one thing that I'm kind of, you know, I guess I'm cautiously watching it, seeing how it's going to play out here and if that'll just, if any, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, it's been the least I'm not going to say just for me. I'm pretty sure I can broad stroke this here, but the leases have been a big part of the overall equipment business for the past 5 years. You know, it feels like every year gets a little bit stronger than it was the year before. And we're in that marketplace where guys are looking at a payment more than they're looking at their equity positions and those kind of things. They're just trying to figure out what the best cost of operation is going to be. And I've said it on here a couple times, but I think leasing's here to stay. I think some of these bigger operators are going to start, you know, looking at their equipment as more of a widget, you know, get a job done and not have that emotional attachment that we've seen in the past, you know, 10 or 15 years ago to that piece of equipment. So I feel like, you know, that leasing is going to have a stay. Now, when you start looking at how it's going to start dictating the balance sheets and what that looks like, that could change that theory pretty quick. So that's something to pay attention to, man. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
All right, Jordan. Well, you know, we've been going here for a little while, and I really appreciate you being on the show. If folks want to check out AgriService and what that is, what's the best place for them to do that?
We've got our website's agriservice.com, agri-service.com. Check out our website. It's actually getting redone right now, so be patient as that transition takes place. But, they can find out all about us out on there.
Right on. All right, Jordan, now got your website there for AgriService. Now, if folks want to reach out and talk to you directly, what's the best way to do that?
So they can call here at the office. Number is 208-734-7772. They could even call my cell phone if they want, 435-770-7850. Always glad to talk to anyone.
Right on. Well, Jordan, I really appreciate you being on the podcast, man, and I will look forward to seeing you again, and we'll catch you down the road, bud.
All right, sounds good.
Moving Iron.
Hello, and welcome to Moving Iron Podcast Markets with Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri Marketing. Chip, how you doing this morning?
Doing well. How you doing, Casey?
No, I'm not doing too bad, man. So, well, we had two events happen here 2 weeks in a row. First, we had that August report come out that got a lot of people fired up, and then we had the Pro Farmer report come out. last week, and then their final report kind of came out midweek this week, and for all intents and purposes, they kind of, I don't know how the best way to put it, they kind of confirmed but denied what the USDA had to say a little bit to some extent. Basically, what I read was count on having about a similar corn crop to what we've seen in the past, but there is some there's a lot of factors that have to play yet. They were talking about some heat issues they were seeing in the northern Corn Belt, as well as some potential early frost concerns. I read that report and I kind of left with as many questions as I had when I started. So I guess what was your opinion of that, and how do you see things shaping up now with the two big things kind of taking place?
I think the two things that jumped out were the immaturity on, mm-hmm. on corn.
Yep.
That's probably first and foremost. And now this weather is a double-edged sword. This whole season has been just hard to get your brain wrapped around, you know. Typically, when you see this kind of weather in the summer, you know, it's 55 at night out here and 74, 75 during the day. We got a little bit of rain a week ago. That's perfect. But then you have this June planted corn that all it's right. doing is just slowing way down. You know, it's not even in the kernel fill stage yet. So it's kind of counterintuitive to think that this kind of weather may not be the best thing that could happen for this June planted corn, but it really is. Probably not a good situation. So that's probably the one thing, is the immaturity and high variability. And typically when you have high variability like that, you don't have top yields. They had their yield, they knocked that down to like 163 and change. So it was about 6 bushels below the USDA. You know, I guess the caveat there was that, assuming normal weather and normal first frost. The problem now is, you talk to agronomists, are twofold. Number one, with the, cooler temperatures here, it's slowing things down. And as you crunch through some of the software and calculations, technology we have available with, you know, plugging in planting dates, growing degree units, a lot of this stuff is slowing down now and won't make black layer until 12th, 15th, 18th of October. And at least right here, kind of the I-74 corridor through Indiana, Illinois, it's about 7th, 8th, 9th of October is when our first frost hits, typically.
Yeah.
So we're going to need a late frost. What that does to the yield, if it's normal or early, no one knows yet. The other big thing that jumped out to me on the Pro Farmer were pod counts on beans.
Right.
And they were significantly lower than a year ago. Now, I understand a year ago was just massive, right? We had a lot of 70 to 80 plus bushel beans out there. But in the Eastern Corn Belt, you know, 20 to as much as 30 plus percent below a year ago pod counts. Now, I am no agronomist, but I've talked to a couple. And there was kind of an underlying theme through that report, you know, through that tour, and then after that, you know, we planted beans late. There's a lot of pods out there, or I should say a lot of blooms. And if we get normal weather, you know, those blooms are going to turn into pods. And I think that's, you know, pipe dream. I think people that think that, you know, need a reality check. Running out of daylight, you know, Saturday's September 1st. And yep. So late planted corn, number one, is going to be a reality check for people as they go out, they start looking at some of that stuff. There's just not enough sunlight. When you have June planted corn and mid-June planted corn in some cases, you run out of sunlight, it's going to tip way back. We're staring at a lot of unknowns. And I think you mentioned it earlier. It's going to take till harvest and beyond, probably to the January crop report, to figure this thing out. And that's the bottom line. And I think, unfortunately, or fortunately, well, either way you think about it, I guess, fortunately for prices, potentially, we're setting ourselves up psychologically to be disappointed by the crop, because the USDA has such a high number here, 169.5. And I think when you get out in it, it's not going to be quite as good as what people expect in a lot of areas. I'm not saying there's not some good corn out there, probably parts of Nebraska, parts of Iowa. You know, there's parts of Illinois that have good corn. But I think just the fact that our phone's ringing this week for people walking their field saying, wow, I thought my early corn. Here's a common theme that we get this week, and it just seems like this week was the week that people started walking fields and calling us. I thought my early corn was going to be 220 and my late corn 180, and I was going to average 200. But I've been out my early corn, and it's 185, and my late corn isn't even yellow yet. It's still immature. So I thought I was going to make 200 a whole farm. I might have made 240, 250 last year, and now I'm probably going to end up under 200. And I think as we go along, there's going to be a lot more of that. So it's not a disaster. It's not a disaster, but I think we're set up to kind of see corn and bean yields both disappoint once harvest starts.
When you look at the market now, what's going to be the catalyst that you start seeing some stuff jump up? Because we're kind of back in that slopping back and forth phase. You know, we'll have a day or two where it goes up 4 or 5, and then it'll drop 4 or 5, and then it'll go up 4 or 5, and then we'll have a day where it falls off 10, and it'll come up 8.5 or whatever, you know, and it's just kind of all over the place. What's that catalyst going to be? Is there going to be enough of that? You know, guys looking at Twitter and listening to U.S. Farm Report and stuff like that, where they're going to start seeing guys talk about this, that traders are going to start maybe going like, maybe there is something here, and they're going to start seeing something, or is it going to have to be that January report that's going to really kind of throw this in the gear one way or the other?
Well, I think the market's still a little shell-shocked with that 90 million acre number.
Yeah.
I think the answer to your question, Casey, is it has to be confirmed by the USDA on monthly crop reports. We've got one coming out September 12th, so that's right around the corner here. And even if – I'm not saying they've got to take 10 bushels off corn yields, but they've got to start into the trend here, either September or October, of them lowering yields, you know, slightly. Even if it's a bushel on corn, that'll get people thinking that, all right, USDA's out there finally. They're checking fields for this report, actual field checks for the September crop report. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic out there. If they start coming down on yields, that might get the market focused that, okay, maybe we've seen the highest yield number. Still, arguably, there's going to be some adjustments on acreage as well. That usually comes on the January crop report. So, you know, if it is the crop size that Pro Farmer says at 163, and they would adjust acreage down a little bit, 1 million to 2 million acres, you know, you're going to cut the carry out enough that's going to give us a rally potential. Maybe not back to the highs at, 470, 475, but probably back north of $4 again. So long answer to your question, the market is going to hear all kinds of stuff on Twitter and different, you know, private crop estimates, but until the USDA moves their numbers, the market's going to assume it's a 169 crop on 90 million planted acres. So,
but what if they do move towards that Pro Farmer number of 163? Is that how much of a jump is that going to make in the market from the 169 number?
You know, I think that you could see a rally eventually back north of $4, 410 to 4.25 range, likely. And you've got some other, all this political stuff going on too. There's some movement on China trade.
Right.
You know, the market got a little bit of a jump yesterday, earlier in the week. There's some talk about from President Trump and Secretary Perdue that they're going to have some sort of good news for ethanol, right? It's kind of ambiguous at this point. You know, because of those exemptions from the small refineries and, you know, that we've seen tweets that are, you know, hinting at good things for farmers before from Washington, and it hasn't turned out. Yeah. But I think a moral victory would be if they just follow the law. I mean, that would maybe get the markets a little bit of confidence and some stability. Just follow the law. How about that?
And
that would be a good start.
Well, Japan's going to buy every kernel of corn we've got, right? Something like that? Weren't they going to do something like that?
Well, I don't know if it's every kernel or 100 million bushels more, somewhere in between, but I think it's probably maybe closer to 100, 150 million bushels more,
yeah.
Which is better than nothing, but I don't think that's every bushel.
No, I've read that tweet, and I'm like, again, really? We're doing this again?
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's crazy.
I mean, it's great. A trade deal's great, you know, but Japan's already the number two buyer of U.S. corn, has been for ever, basically, right. So... they already buy a lot of stuff. Now, that's, you know, I don't want to minimize it. That's good for beef and pork and other. I mean, it's a good deal, but the tweet that they're going to buy all our corn, little bit of a stretch.
Last time I saw it happen, we had a trade war about 2 weeks later start, so I don't know if we
can. Yeah, exactly. Unless they're going to buy all the corn and then resell it to China. That maybe that's what,
you maybe know, that could be, know. Yeah, that could be happening too.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right, snip over the cattle complex, take a look what's happening there. Cattle's kind of been here, there, and everywhere. So talk about what you see happening there and what kind of moves you see going into this fall time frame that are coming out of us here.
Yeah, fall, I think that, you know, let's go back 2 weeks. We had the fire at the Tyson plant.
Yep.
Cattle, you know, just juked like $10, $12, a couple limit down moves immediately with all the uncertainty there. I think there's still some uncertainty there, but here's the interesting thing. Other plants have, you know, increased hours and killed on the weekends. And for 2 weeks running, we killed almost as many cattle as we did with the Tyson plant online. So we've picked up the slack a little bit. Packers are still making a huge amount of money. But it's been a little disappointing that you haven't seen a better bounce. I think that will come. We had a cattle on feed report a week ago. It was, you know, touch friendly. It came in about 1% below average estimates in all three categories. I think that longer term, obviously, you're close to a low here. As you get, you know, the next 6 weeks may be a little sideways and sloppy, but I think as you get deeper into fall and then approaching winter, things look better. I still think that you could, you know, maybe put $10, $12 on, you know, kind of like winter and spring live cattle. This trade agreement, you know, we were kind of joking about it earlier, but it is going to be a good thing, for beef and pork, poultry. So, you know, you get some exports cranked out to Japan and you know, that can help the cattle complex a little bit too.
Yep. There's it's kind of back and forth. You kind of watch those export reports and you start seeing a lot of, I've seen a lot more of those, destination unknowns or however they word that popping up in there that kind of lets you know that, you know, China's taking some stuff here and there, but they had a big, they take a bunch of beef last week or this week or something like that on the exports, China.
Well, you know, here's the thing about China and beef. It's been, the most, poorly kept secrets, in ag. But China's taken our beef, just not directly, right?
Right.
So we've seen some pretty big sales to Hong Kong in the last month or so.
That was
A lot of beef moves through Taiwan. You know, if you look at the population of Taiwan and crunch out how much beef they buy from us, the per capita beef consumption in Taiwan is, you know, something like five times more than what it is here.
Yeah.
So, you know, point being, China's getting our beef. It's just maybe not going directly to China. They've got a problem with this pork thing, though. You know, their pork prices are, I think, about a little more than three times higher than what our pork prices are. And I think they're about to the end of the rope there. Mm-hmm. So they're gonna ramp up protein imports, you know, whether that's poultry, beef, pork, probably all three. So we have some stuff to gain there. Just be good to get a little clarity or at least some stability on this trade war. Just seems like about every other week it takes a turn for the worse, but I don't know how much worse it can be at this point.
Yep. That's one other thing too, the African swine fever. It's kind of, you hear every once in a while you kind of get like a page six type of report on what's going on over there, but it's kind of died off. But everything that you read is like it's worse than we thought every time it comes out, and it still hasn't made. It's being very suppressed, it feels like, compared to what it was, you know, back this winter.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the news industry needs fresh, sexy news, and African swine fever definitely isn't.
Right.
But it's still there. It hasn't gone away. And it's, you know, I think most estimates are now that they've lost about half their hog herd.
Yep.
Or just under. So I think some things that were going on there, this is just speculation on my part and stuff reading between the lines, because you don't get real good news out of China for good reason. They want it that way. You're only going to get the pieces of information they want you to know. But here's what I think kind of happened. We had that big run up in pork prices immediately after, you know, became apparent that they had a big problem on the expectation they were going to buy a bunch of our pork. And they have bought some, but I think what happened was, whether citizens there know it or not, some of what was slaughtered made it back into the food chain, because it's, you know, allegedly, supposedly, not transferable to humans, via the meat. And, or at all for that matter,
right.
But certainly not to the meat. So I think some of the liquidation made it into their food supply and, you know, allowed them to stretch out a little bit. They're probably coming up to the end of that. And, you know, whether that's part of this trade deal or whether they just say, hey, in spite of tariffs, we're going to buy pork, right? Even with the tariffs, it's going to be cheaper than what their domestic prices are. So, they're kind of, I think their backs are against the wall a little bit on that respect. And I would think that eventually here, and probably sooner rather than later, they are going to have to come to the United States for, you know, maybe many different protein sources.
Yeah.
And that could even include beans, because coming in the time frame where South America is probably getting dwindling supplies of their recently harvested crop. We typically, from about harvest to January, February, pick up some more exports. So you could even see, you know, a few new sales to China here on the beans in spite of the tariffs. And hopefully there's talk that, you know, again, it's like a broken record, but we're going to potentially hold some more trade talks in September. Elections coming up here. You know, something's going to have to give. I think without a trade agreement, you know, Trump's not going to be in the White House.
Right.
I really feel that. I mean, yeah. You know, farm states got them in there.
Farmers
are hurting right now.
Yeah.
And it's not just farmers. It goes up the line, right? You say, wow, farmers aren't that big of a percent. But it goes right up the line to, number one, you know, farmers are hurting. Incomes are as low as they've been in 6-7 years. And now we've had a poor crop on top of that in a lot of areas. So it goes right upstream to fertilizer companies, you know, yep. Equipment companies, seed companies, any ag business. It really affects the ag economy in the middle part of the country. And, you know, we need a trade deal.
Yep.
And it should be a good deal, but let's stop tweeting and start getting something done.
Stop talking about it and start being about it. It's what drives me nuts about this whole thing, man. They just, every time I turn around, there's some tweet about something that's going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it comes out to be worse than the invention of sliced bread.
I think that's wearing thin. I really do. It still works in the financial market, the stock market, for some reason.
Yeah.
I think in the grain markets, you know, action, not words. That's what what we want right now.
Remember the moves we've seen?
Grain markets haven't figured out. He can still, seems like, manipulate the stock market higher with a tweet or two. They haven't figured that part out yet.
Yeah.
But I think that they the time could come soon that they are.
Yeah, we'd watch those swings in the marketplace on every little tweet we saw. And now there's zero effect. Nothing happens when something comes out.
Yeah.
It's a trust, but double, quadruple verify before we do anything else moving forward. So, crazy.
Yeah, but it's a boy who cried wolf at this point. You know, the first couple times it was great, but, you know, we're going on, I don't know what it is now, 15, 16 months of this crap, and, you know, tweets don't matter anymore.
Yep, no, it's crazy. So, all right, Chip, hey, plenty of stuff going on. Good time to work that plan. 2020 will be here before you know it, and we're moving into that key marketing time. First year, so folks are working on a plan or have a plan, they need to have you revise or maybe even just kick them in the right direction. What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, best ways is give us a call, 309-550-7213. This is a great time to do some planning, right? I mean, on the grain side, crop insurance plays a part of this. So, you know, it's been a little bit depressing, a little bit frustrating with USDA numbers, frustrating with a wet crop and, you know, wet planting. But it is not a time to stick your head in the sand and you know, forget about the markets. It's prime time, and there's some maneuvering you could do right now. So it's critical to have a plan, and if you don't have one, it's not too late to get one because it's still going to be volatile out there.
Yep. I know guys are working their plan this about a month ago, and they're selling grain for 50 or 60 cents higher than what it is right now. So very important to pay attention to what's going on and know what your reaction points are going to be.
No doubt. No doubt. A lot of moving parts to it.
Absolutely. All right. Chip, thanks this morning. Have a good one. And this is Chip Nellinger with Blue Reef Agri-Marketing. So, Chip, we'll talk to you later, man.
All right. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Moving Iron Podcast, now part of the Global Ag Network. If you'd like to continue any of these conversations, you can hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Moving Iron LLC. You can also send me an email at Moving Iron Podcast at MovingIronPodcast.com. You can also visit the Moving Iron Podcast YouTube channel and watch Market Roundup with Chip Nellinger, Sean Hackett, and Angie Setzer. Also, Tax News with Glenn Birnbaum. Please visit MovingIronLLC.com. Here you can find information, details, and updates for the 2019 Moving Iron Summit in Nashville, Tennessee. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can leave a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, and GlobalAgNetwork.com. So until next time, let's go move some iron. This is Casey Seymour. Out.
Moving iron in the 21st century. Hardworking people working hard for you and me. Moving iron time and time again. Through the years you'll find a scene.